This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of thromboembolism prophylaxis, including prophylaxis of pulmonary embolism and deep vein thrombosis, from the basic science section on OrthoBullets.com. We will first discuss the incidence, risk factors, and pathophysiology for thromboembolism. We will then provide an overview of venous thromboembolism prophylaxis and discuss prophylaxis in hip and knee arthroplasty, spine surgery, shoulder arthroplasty, and foot and ankle surgery. Regarding the incidence of thromboembolism, venous thromboembolism, or VTE, includes both pulmonary embolism, or PE, and deep vein thrombosis, or DVT. Most of these thromboemboli are clinically silent. The U.S. incidence of DVT is approximately 200,000 per year, and the U.S. incidence of PE is approximately 50,000 per year. Regarding the risk factors for thromboembolism, the risk factors include Virchow's triad, primary hypercoagulopathies which are inherited, and secondary risk factors which are acquired. Virchow's triad includes venous stasis, a hypercoagulable state, and intimal injury. There are various primary hypercoagulopathies that are inherited to be aware of. The first to discuss is the MTHFR/C677T/TT gene mutation, which carries the highest risk of developing thromboembolism. This is followed by factor V Leiden mutation, antithrombin 3 deficiency, protein C or protein S deficiency, activated protein C resistance, elevated factor VIII, hyperhomocysteinemia, and prothrombin 2 G20210A. Secondary risk factors for thromboemboli, or the acquired risk factors, may include malignancy, elevated hormone conditions, elevated antiphospholipid antibody conditions, history of venous thromboembolism, obesity, aging, CHF, varicose veins, smoking, general anesthetic as opposed to epidural or spinal anesthetic, immobilization, increased blood viscosity, and a rapidly increasing INR following unopposed initiation of warfarin therapy in arthroplasty patients. Regarding malignancy, malignancy has recently been associated with up to 20% of all new diagnoses of VTE. Some of the elevated hormone conditions to be aware of that predispose to VTE include recombinant erythropoietin use, hormone replacement therapy, oral contraceptive therapy, and late pregnancy. The relevant elevated antiphospholipid antibody conditions include lupus anticoagulant and anticardiolipin antibody. Regarding the increase in venous thromboembolism risk following rapid increase in INR following unopposed initiation of warfarin therapy in arthroplasty patients, this is hypothesized to occur due to the warfarin-induced decline in protein C occurring before warfarin's antithrombotic effect occurs. This occurs because protein C has a half-life of 6 to 8 hours and factor II has a half-life of 48 to 120 hours. Notably, no increase in DVT has been associated with the use of transexamic acid, otherwise known as TXA. When discussing these risk factors, it is important to note that there is an increasing incidence of pediatric VTE due to obesity, contraceptives, and smoking, amongst other risk factors. To briefly discuss the pathophysiology of venous thromboembolism, the mechanism of clot formation is via stasis, fibrin formation, clot retraction, and propagation. Fibrin formation occurs through thromboplastin, otherwise known as tissue factor, platelet tissue factor, or factor III, which is released during dissection and leads to activation of the extrinsic pathway and fibrin formation. To provide a brief overview of thromboembolism prophylaxis, the prevention of DVT and PE is the most important factor in decreasing morbidity and mortality. Prophylaxis treatment should be determined by weighing risk of bleeding versus the risk of pulmonary embolism. The AAOS risk factors for major bleeding include bleeding disorders, a history of recent gastrointestinal bleed, or a history of recent hemorrhagic stroke. The AAOS risk factors for pulmonary embolism include a hypercoagulable state and previously documented pulmonary embolism. Notably, DVT prophylaxis is recommended for all arthroplasty patients. However, for standard patients, DVT prophylaxis is not recommended in upper extremity procedures, arthroscopy, or any isolated fractures at the knee or below. The use of pharmacologic prophylaxis and mechanical compression received a moderate strength recommendation from the AAOS. Regarding prophylaxis in hip and knee arthroplasty, the prophylaxis regimen in hip and knee replacement includes VTE prophylaxis recommended for all THA and TKA patients. The AAOS and American College of Chest Physicians developed guidelines on DVT prophylaxis but do not recommend an optimal regimen. An individualized prophylaxis regimen balancing efficacy and safety based on risk factors should be implemented. Regarding mechanical prophylaxis, compressive stockings are recommended, and pneumatic compressive devices are recommended by the AAOS for all risk groups undergoing total hip and total knee arthroplasty, regardless of if it's low or high risk of either bleeding or pulmonary embolism. There is an increase in venous return and endothelial-derived fibrinolysis, as well as a decrease in venous compliance and venous stasis with the use of pneumatic compressive devices. Regarding chemoprophylaxis in hip and knee arthroplasty, the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, or AAOS, and American College of Chest Physicians, or ACCP, support aspirin as a monotherapy. For further review on anticoagulation and medical treatment options, please see the anticoagulation section on orthobullets.com. Regarding DVT prophylaxis in spine surgery, there is no clear consensus regarding the utilization or timing of VTE prophylaxis measures after spine surgery. The risks of VTE formation must be weighed against the risks of postoperative bleeding and epidural hematoma formation. Patients with a spinal cord injury and prolonged immobilization are at an increased risk of VTE. Early mobilization is recommended, along with pneumatic compressive devices. Chemoprophylaxis should be considered for patients with longer surgical times, multi-level thoracolumbar surgery, and anterior thoracolumbar approaches. Regarding the VTE prophylaxis in shoulder arthroplasty, early mobilization and mechanical prophylaxis, as well as the use of regional anesthesia, is the primary recommendation. Low molecular weight heparin, or heparin, can be given until a patient is ambulatory if they are at increased risk, but not for routine use in upper extremity surgery. Aspirin and antiplatelet agents are not adequate prophylaxis. Lastly, regarding foot and ankle surgery prophylaxis, the risk of VTE was not found to be lowered by thromboprophylaxis in a study of 20,043 adult patients. Now that we've gotten a general overview of this topic, let's review a few questions to see how this material has been tested in the past. Question 1. According to the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons AAOS Clinical Practice Guidelines, all of the following have been shown to decrease venous thromboembolism risk following total knee arthroplasty, except 1. Early mobilization. 2. Aspirin. 3. Coumadin. 4. Neuraxial anesthesia. Or 5. Pneumatic compression boots. The correct answer is 4. Neuraxial anesthesia. From the AAOS Clinical Practice Guidelines, the use of neuraxial anesthesia does not alter the risk factors of venous thromboembolism, or VTE, in elective total hip and knee arthroplasty. Deep vein thrombosis following total joint arthroplasty is clinically silent in 20% of cases and is potentially fatal. The use of pharmacologic and/or mechanical compression, the use of neuraxial anesthesia, and the discontinuation of antiplatelet medications prior to surgery received moderate recommendations. However, the use of neuraxial anesthesia and discontinuation of antiplatelet medications 1 week prior to surgery has not been found to decrease the rates of VTE, but rather reduces intraoperative blood loss. Lewis et al. Conducted a prospective study of 3,289 patients undergoing hip and knee arthroplasty procedures using either aspirin 325 mg twice daily for 6 weeks or 40 mg low molecular weight heparin daily for 7 to 12 days as set forth by the AAOS guidelines in 2009. The authors reported a 90-day VTE rate of 1.1%, with total hip arthroplasty patients having less VTE rates than total knee arthroplasty patients, 0.56% compared to 1.46%. The authors concluded that the AAOS guidelines are effective at reducing VTE rates following arthroplasty procedures. Mont et al. presented the AAOS Clinical Practice Guidelines for Preventing VTE in Patients Undergoing Elective Hip and Knee Arthroplasty. They issued a moderate strength recommendation for the use of pharmacologic prophylaxis in patients without increased bleeding risks and/or mechanical compression. No specific pharmacologic or mechanical compression recommendations were given. To review the incorrect answers, answer 1, early mobilization, was given a consensus strength recommendation by the AAOS due to the low cost, minimal risk, and being consistent with current practice. Regarding answer 2, aspirin, the AAOS did not give specific pharmacologic prophylaxis recommendations, but aspirin has been shown in several studies to decrease VTE rates in hip and knee arthroplasty patients while minimizing wound complications. Similarly, regarding answer 3, Coumadin, again, the AAOS does not give specific recommendations regarding pharmacologic prophylaxis. However, they gave a moderate strength recommendation for the use of pharmacologic prophylaxis and/or mechanical compression in patients without a history of bleeding disorders and/or active liver disease. And finally, regarding answer 5, the use of mechanical compression devices has received a moderate strength recommendation by the AAOS, and this has been shown in studies to prevent the development of DVT and subsequent VTE. Question 2. Which of the following is true regarding venous thromboembolism or VTE following major orthopedic hip or knee surgery? 1. Almost all patients receive VTE prophylaxis, though often not in compliance with the American College of Chest Physicians or ACCP guidelines. 2. Length of hospitalization and associated medical costs are significantly increased by in-hospital VTE, but not post-discharge VTE. 3. Most acute perioperative pulmonary events result from dislodged chronic deep vein thrombosis resulting in pulmonary embolism. 4. Most symptomatic VTE occur within 2 weeks after total joint arthroplasty. Or 5. Warfarin prophylaxis is more often fully compliant with ACCP guidelines than low molecular weight heparin prophylaxis. The correct answer is 1. Almost all patients receive VTE prophylaxis, though often not in compliance with ACCP guidelines. While almost all patients undergoing major orthopedic procedures receive VTE prophylaxis, this is often not within the ACCP postoperative VTE prophylaxis guidelines. VTE events typically occur following hospital discharge within the first 2 to 6 weeks following surgery. Risk is increased with major orthopedic surgery due to greater soft tissue disruption, venous stasis from limb manipulation, and postoperative immobility. VTE following major orthopedic hip and knee surgery represents not only a significant cause of postoperative morbidity and mortality, but contributes a substantial economic burden. Prophylaxis is the single most important factor in mitigating the risk of VTE. Therefore, adherence to the AAOS and ACCP guidelines is recommended. Friedman et al. Evaluated the compliance of physicians with ACCP postoperative VTE prophylaxis guidelines following total knee and hip arthroplasty. The authors found moderate compliance overall, with 47% of total hip and 61% of total knee arthroplasty patients receiving appropriate prophylaxis in terms of type, duration, start time, and dose. Compliance with warfarin use was the lowest, while that with low molecular weight heparin was significantly higher. They concluded that while almost all patients received prophylaxis, this was often not within the guidelines. Oster et al. Investigated the economic consequences of VTE following major orthopedic hip or knee surgery. The authors found that 2.2% of patients developed clinically significant VTE, 62% after hospital discharge, and that the patients who developed in-hospital VTE had a significantly longer length of hospital stay and associated costs than those that developed VTE out of hospital and were later readmitted. They concluded that the economic impact of VTE was substantial regardless of the setting. Regarding the incorrect answers, answer 2, length of hospitalization and associated medical costs are significantly increased by in-hospital VTE, but not post-discharge VTE. This is incorrect, as the length of hospitalization and associated medical costs are significantly increased by VTE, whether occurring in hospital or following discharge. Answer 3. Most acute perioperative pulmonary events result from dislodged chronic deep vein thrombosis resulting in pulmonary embolism. This is incorrect, as most acute perioperative pulmonary events are due to fat embolism or cardiac events. Answer 4. Most symptomatic VTE occur within 2 weeks after total joint arthroplasty. This is incorrect, as most VTE events have been found to occur following hospital discharge between 2 and 6 weeks following total joint arthroplasty. And finally, answer 5. Warfarin prophylaxis is more often fully compliant with ACCP guidelines than low molecular weight heparin prophylaxis. This is incorrect, as low molecular weight heparin prophylaxis was fully compliant with ACCP guidelines more often than warfarin prophylaxis for both total hip and total knee arthroplasty. In total hip arthroplasty, low molecular weight heparin was compliant 63% of the time as compared to 33% of the time with warfarin, and in total knee arthroplasty, low molecular weight heparin was compliant 72% of the time versus 48% of the time with warfarin. Last question. A 59-year-old patient undergoing total hip arthroplasty has a genetically inherited thrombophilia disorder. In this disorder, a variant cofactor cannot be inhibited by activated protein C, causing overproduction of thrombin. What is this patient's clotting disorder? 1. Factor V laden. 2. Antithrombin 3 deficiency. 3. Familial dysfibrinogenemia. 4. Protein S deficiency. Or 5. Congenital deficiency of plasminogen. The correct answer is 1. Factor V laden. This patient has factor V laden thrombophilia. Factor V laden thrombophilia is a variant of human factor V that causes hypercoagulability. Factor V functions as a cofactor to allow for factor 10A to activate thrombin. Thrombin in turn cleaves fibrinogen to form fibrin, which polymerizes to form a clot. Deficiency prevents efficient inactivation of factor V by activated protein C, causing overproduction of thrombin. Seligson and Lubetsky reviewed hereditary thrombophilia. Factor V laden is an autosomal dominant genetic condition that exhibits incomplete dominance. 5% of Caucasians in North America have factor V laden. It is less common in Latin Americans and African Americans, and rare in people of Asian descent. Reviewing the incorrect answers, answer 2, or antithrombin 3 deficiency, is incorrect, as antithrombin 3 is a potent inhibitor of the coagulation cascade. Normally, it inhibits coagulation by lysing thrombin and factor 10A. Antithrombin 3 deficiency causes abnormal clotting. Answer 3, familial dysfibrinogenemia, is a rare inherited abnormality of fibrin molecules which result in defective fibrin clot formation. Answer 4, protein S deficiency is incorrect, as the function of protein S is to inactivate factor 5A and factor 8A in the clotting cascade. Protein S deficiency causes abnormalities in this clotting cascade. And answer 5, congenital deficiency of plasminogen. This is incorrect, as congenital deficiency of plasminogen is a rare disorder. Plasminogen is needed to break down clots, and an inability to break down clots will lead to clot formation. That is all for this review on thromboembolism prophylaxis. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. Keep in mind that these podcasts are designed to go along with the topics on orthobullets.com, and in fact, you can listen to these episodes right on the OrthoBullets website or the mobile app while going through the topic. If you've gotten any value from the OrthoBullets podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Also, if you are not already, please be sure to follow OrthoBullets on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube for daily high-yield content. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you all tomorrow, right here on the OrthoBullets podcast.
Thank you.